At the Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft. Read by Richard Coyle. Part 1. The Discovery. I am forced into speech because men of science have refused to follow my advice without knowing why. It is altogether against my will that I tell my reasons for opposing this contemplated invasion of the Antarctic, with its vast fossil hunt and its wholesale boring and melting of the ancient ice caps. And I am the more reluctant because my warning may be in vain. In the end, I must rely on the judgment and standing of the few scientific leaders who have, on the one hand, sufficient independence of thought to weigh my data on its own hideously convincing merits, or in the light of certain primordial and highly baffling myth cycles, and on the other hand, sufficient influence to deter the exploring world in general from any rash and overambitious program in the region of those mountains of madness. It is an unfortunate fact that relatively obscure men like myself and my associates, connected only with a small university, have little chance of making an impression where matters of a wildly bizarre or highly controversial nature are concerned. As a geologist, my object in leading the Miskatonic University expedition was wholly that of securing deep-level specimens of rock and soil from various parts of the Antarctic continent, aided by the remarkable drill devised by Professor Frank H. Parbody of our engineering department. I had no wish to be a pioneer in any other field than this, but I did hope that the use of this new mechanical appliance at different points along previously explored paths would bring to light materials of a sort hitherto unreached by the ordinary methods of collection. We plan to cover as great an area as one Antarctic season, or longer if absolutely necessary, would permit, operating mostly in the mountain ranges and on the plateau south of Ross Sea, regions explored in varying degree by Shackleton, Amundsen, Scott, and Bird. With frequent changes of camp, made by aeroplane and involving distances great enough to be of geological significance, we expected to unearth a quite unprecedented amount of material, especially in the Precambrian strata of which so narrow a range of Antarctic specimens had previously been secured. We wished also to obtain as great as possible a variety of the upper fossiliferous rocks, since the primal life history of this bleak realm of ice and death is of the highest importance to our knowledge of the Earth's past. The public knows of the Miskatonic expedition through our frequent wireless reports to the Arkham Advertiser and Associated Press, and through the later articles of Parbody and myself. We consisted of four men from the university: Parbody, Lake of the Biology Department, Atwood of the Physics Department, also a meteorologist, and myself, representing geology and having nominal command, besides 16 assistants, 7 graduate students from Miskatonic, and 9 skilled mechanics. Of these 16, 12 were qualified aeroplane pilots, all but 2 of whom were competent wireless operators. 8 of them understood navigation with compass and sextant, as did Parbody, Atwood, and I. In addition, of course, our 2 ships, wooden ex-whalers, reinforced for ice conditions and having auxiliary steam, were fully manned. As the newspapers told, we sailed from Boston Harbor on September the 2nd, 1930, taking a leisurely course down the coast and through the Panama Canal, and stopping at Samoa and Hobart, Tasmania, at which latter place we took on final supplies. None of our exploring party had ever been in the polar regions before, hence we all relied greatly on our ship captains. J.B. Douglas, commanding the brig Arkham and serving as commander of the Sea Party, and George Thorfinson, commanding the barque Miskatonic, both veteran whalers in Antarctic waters. As we left the inhabited world behind, the sun sank lower and lower in the north and stayed longer and longer above the horizon each day. At about 62 degrees south latitude, we sighted our first icebergs, table-like objects with vertical sides. And just before reaching the Antarctic Circle, which we crossed on October the 20th with appropriately quaint ceremonies, we were considerably troubled with field ice. The falling temperature bothered me considerably after our long voyage through the tropics, but I tried to brace up for the worst rigors to come. On many occasions, the curious atmospheric effects enchanted me vastly, these including a strikingly vivid mirage, the first I had ever seen, in which distant bergs became the battlements of unimaginable cosmic castles. The last lap of the voyage was vivid and fancy-stirring. Great barren peaks of mystery loomed up constantly against the west as the low northern sun of noon, or the still lower horizon-grazing southern sun of midnight, poured its hazy reddish rays over the white snow, bluish ice and water lanes, and black bits of exposed granite slope. Through the desolate summits swept ranging, intermittent gusts of the terrible Antarctic wind, whose cadences sometimes held vague suggestions of a wild and half-sentient musical piping, with notes extending over a wide range, and which, for some subconscious mnemonic reason, seemed to me disquieting and even dimly terrible. On the 7th of November, we passed Franklin Island, and the next day descried the cones of Mounts Erebus and Terror on Ross Island ahead, with the long line of the Parry Mountains beyond. There now stretched off to the east the low, white line of the Great Ice Barrier, rising perpendicularly to a height of 200 feet like the rocky cliffs of Quebec, and marking the end of southward navigation. In the afternoon, we entered McMurdo Sound and stood off the coast in the lee of smoking Mount Erebus. The Soryak Peak towered up some 12,700 feet against the eastern sky, like a Japanese print of the sacred Fujiyama, while beyond it rose the white, ghost-like height of Mount Terror, 10,900 feet in altitude, and now extinct as a volcano. Puffs of smoke from Erebus came intermittently, and one of the graduate assistants, a brilliant young fellow named Danforth, pointed out what looked like lava on the snowy slope. Using small boats, we effected a difficult landing on Ross Island shortly after midnight on the morning of the 9th, carrying a line of cable from each of the ships and preparing to unload supplies by means of a breeches buoy arrangement. Our sensations on first treading Antarctic soil were poignant and complex, even though at this particular point the Scott and Shackleton expeditions had preceded us. Our camp on the frozen shore below the volcano slope was only a provisional one, headquarters being kept aboard the Arkham. We landed all our drilling apparatus, dogs, sledges, tents, provisions, gasoline tanks, experimental ice melting outfit, cameras, both ordinary and aerial, aeroplane parts and other accessories, including three small portable wireless outfits, besides those in the planes, capable of communicating with the Arkham's large outfit from any part of the Antarctic continent that we would be likely to visit. The ship's equipment, communicating with the outside world, was to convey press reports to the Arkham Advertiser's powerful wireless station on Kingsport Head, Massachusetts. I need not repeat what the newspapers have already published about our early work, of our ascent of Mount Erebus, our successful mineral borings at several points on Ross Island, and the singular speed with which Parbury's apparatus accomplished them, even through solid rock layers. Our provisional test of the small ice-melting equipment, our perilous ascent of the Great Barrier with sledges and supplies, and our final assembling of five huge aeroplanes at the camp atop the barrier. Only four of our planes were needed to carry the actual exploring material, the fifth being left with a pilot and two men from the ships at the storage cache to form a means of reaching us from the Arkham in case all our exploring planes were lost. Wireless reports have spoken of the breathtaking four-hour non-stop flight of our squadron on November the 21st over the lofty shelf ice, with vast peaks rising on the west and the unfathomed silences echoing to the sound of our engines. Wind troubled us only moderately, and our radio compasses helped us through the one opaque fog we encountered. When the vast rise loomed ahead between latitudes 83 degrees and 84 degrees, we knew we had reached the Beardmore Glacier, the largest valley glacier in the world, and that the frozen sea was now giving place to a frowning and mountainous coastline. At last, we were truly entering the white, eon-dead world of the ultimate south. The outside world was told also of Professor Lake's strange and dogged insistence on a westward, or rather northwestward, prospecting trip. Popular imagination, I judge, responded actively to our wireless bulletins of Lake's start into regions never trodden by human foot or penetrated by human imagination, though we did not mention his wild hopes of revolutionizing the entire sciences of biology and geology. I still failed to see the good sense of Lake's demand for an interlude in our time-saving program. An interlude requiring the use of all four planes, many men, and the whole of the expedition's mechanical apparatus. I did not, in the end, veto the plan, though I decided not to accompany the northwestward party, despite Lake's plea for my geological advice. While they were gone, I would remain at the base with Parbody and five men and work out final plans for an eastward shift. The start was made January 22nd at 4 a.m., and the first wireless message we received from Lake came only 2 hours later.
10:05 p.m., on the wing. After snowstorm have spied mountain range ahead higher than any hitherto seen, may equal Himalayas, allowing for height of plateau. Probable latitude 76 degrees 15 minutes, longitude 113 degrees 10 minutes east. Reach as far as can see to right and left. Suspicion of two smoking cones. All peaks black and bare of snow. Gale blowing off them impedes navigation.
After that, Parbody, the men, and I hung breathlessly over the receiver. Thought of this titanic mountain rampart inflamed our deepest sense of adventure, and we rejoiced that our expedition, if not ourselves personally, had been its discoverers. In half an hour, Lake called us again.
Moulton's plane forced down on plateau and foothills, but nobody hurt and perhaps can repair. Shall transfer essentials to other three for return or further moves if necessary, but no more heavy plane travel needed just now. Mountains surpass anything in imagination. Am going up scouting in Carol's plane with all weight out. You can't imagine anything like this. Highest peaks must go over 35,000 feet. Everest out of the running. Atwood to work out height with theodolite while Carol and I go up. Probably wrong about cones, for formations look stratified. Possibly Precambrian slate with other strata mixed in. Queer skyline effects. Regular sections of cubes clinging to highest peaks. Whole thing marvelous in red-gold light of low sun. Like land of mystery in a dream. Or gateway to forbidden world of untrodden wonder.
Though it was technically sleeping time, not one of us listeners thought for a moment of retiring. Then, at 11 p.m., came another call from Lake.
Up with Carol. Carroll over highest foothills. Am up 21,500 myself in devilish, gnawing cold. Wind whistles and pipes through passes and in and out of caves, but no flying danger so far.
From then on, for another half hour, Lake kept up a running fire of comment and expressed his intention of climbing some of the peaks on foot. I replied that I would join him as soon as he could send a plane, and that Parbody and I would work out the best gasoline plan. Just where and how to concentrate our supply in view of the expedition's altered character. Obviously, Lake's boring operations, as well as his aeroplane activities, would require a great deal for the new base, which he planned to establish at the foot of the mountains, and it was possible that the eastward flight might not be made, after all, this season. In connection with this business, I called Captain Douglas and asked him to get as much as possible out of the ships and up the barrier with the single dog team we had left there. A direct route across the unknown region between Lake and McMurdo Sound was what we really ought to establish. Lake called me later to say that he'd decided to let the camp stay where Moulton's plane had been forced down and where repairs had already progressed somewhat. In the morning, I had a three-cornered wireless talk with Lake and Captain Douglas at their widely separated bases. It was agreed that one of Lake's planes would come to my base for Parbody, the five men, and myself, as well as for all the fuel it could carry. The rest of the fuel question, depending on our decision about an easterly trip, could wait for a few days, since Lake had enough for immediate camp heat and borings. Eventually, the old southern base ought to be restocked, but if we postponed the easterly trip, we would not use it till the next summer, and meanwhile, Lake must send a plane to explore a direct route between his new mountains and McMurdo Sound. After about 4 p.m., Lake began sending in the most extraordinary and excited messages. His working day had started unpropitiously, since an aeroplane survey of the nearly exposed rock surfaces showed an entire absence of those Archean and primordial strata for which he was looking, and which formed so great a part of the colossal peaks that loomed up at a tantalizing distance from the camp. It was about 3 hours afterward, following the first really heavy blast of the operation, that the shouting of the drill crew was heard, and that young Gedney, the acting foreman, rushed into the camp with the startling news. They had struck a cave. Early in the boring, the sandstone had given place to a vein of Comanchean limestone full of minute fossil cephalopods, corals, echini, and spirifera, and with occasional suggestions of siliceous sponges and marine vertebrate bones, the latter probably of teleosts, sharks, and ganoids. This in itself was important enough, as affording the first vertebrate fossils the expedition had yet secured. But when, shortly afterward, the drill head dropped through the stratum into apparent vacancy, a wholly new and doubly intense wave of excitement spread among the excavators. A good-sized blast had laid open the subterranean secret, and now, through a jagged aperture perhaps 5 feet across and 3 feet thick, there yawned before the avid searchers a section of shallow limestone hollowing worn more than 50 million years ago by the trickling groundwaters of a bygone tropic world. When Lake had satisfied the first keen edge of his curiosity, he scribbled a message in his notebook and had young Moulton run back to the camp to dispatch it by wireless. This was my first word of the discovery. Lake was not content to let his first message stand, but had another bulletin written and dispatched across the snow to the camp before Moulton could get back. After that, Moulton stayed at the wireless in one of the planes, transmitting to me and to the Arkham for relaying to the outside world the frequent postscripts which Lake sent him by a succession of messengers. Those who followed the newspapers will remember the excitement created among men of science by that afternoon's reports. Reports which have finally led, after all these years, to the organization of the proposed Starkweather Moor expedition, which I am so anxious to dissuade from its purposes. I had better give the messages literally as Lake sent them, and as our base operator McTighe translated them from the pencil shorthand.
Fowler makes discovery of highest importance in sandstone and limestone fragments from blasts. Several distinct triangular striated prints like those in Archean slate, proving that source survived from over 600 million years ago to Comanchean times without more than moderate morphological changes and decrease in average size. Comanchean prints apparently more primitive or decadent, if anything, than older ones, emphasize importance of discovery in press. Will mean to biology what Einstein has meant to mathematics and physics. Joins up with my previous work and amplifies conclusions. Appears to indicate, as I suspected, that Earth has seen whole cycle or cycles of organic life before known one that begins with archaeozoic cells, was evolved and specialized not later than 1,000 million years ago, when planet was young and recently uninhabitable for any life forms or normal protoplasmic structure. Question arises when, where, and how development took place.
And then later,
examining certain skeletal fragments of large land and marine saurians and primitive mammals, find singular local wounds or injuries to bony structure not attributable to any known predatory or carnivorous animal of any period, of two sorts, straight, penetrant bores and apparently hacking incisions, one or two cases of cleanly severed bones.
And still later,
have found peculiar soapstone fragment, about 6 inches across and 1.5 inches thick, wholly unlike any visible local formation, greenish, but no evidences to place its period. Has curious smoothness and regularity, shaped like 5-pointed star with tips broken off, and signs of other cleavage at inward angles and in center of surface. Small, smooth depression in center of unbroken surface. Carroll, with magnifier, thinks he can make out additional markings of geologic significance. Groups of tiny dots in regular patterns. Dogs growing uneasy as we work and seem to hate this soapstone. Must see if it has any peculiar odor. We'll report again when Mills gets back with light and we start on underground area. 10:15 p.m. Incredible. No, transcendent discovery. Arendorf and Watkins, working underground at 9:45 with light, found 8 complete and 6 incomplete specimens of hitherto unknown life forms. They are the Archean things that left the prints in the rocks we found earlier. 6 feet end to end. 3 5/10 feet central diameter, tapering to 1 foot at each end. Like a barrel, with 5 bulging ridges in place of staves. Dark gray, flexible, and infinitely tough hide, miraculously preserved. 7-foot membranous wings of same color, found folded, spread out of furrows between ridges. Wing framework tubular or glandular of lighter gray with orifices at wingtips. Spread wings have serrated edge. Around equator, one at central apex of each of the 5 vertical stave-like ridges are 5 systems of light gray flexible arms or tentacles found tightly folded to torso but expansible to maximum length of over 3 feet. Single stalks 3 inches diameter branch after 6 inches into 5 substalks, each of which branches after 8 inches into small tapering tentacles or tendrils, giving each stalk a total of 25 tentacles. At top of torso, blunt, bulbous neck of lighter gray with gill-like suggestions, holds yellowish, five-pointed, starfish-shaped apparent head covered with 3-inch wiry cilia of various prismatic colors. Head thick and puffy, about 2 feet point-to-point, with 3-inch flexible yellowish tubes projecting from each point. Slit in exact center of top, probably breathing aperture. At end of each tube is spherical expansion where yellowish membrane rolls back on handling to reveal glassy, red-irised globe, evidently an eye. 5 slightly longer reddish tubes start from inner angles of starfish-shaped head and end in sac-like swellings of same color, which, upon pressure, open to bell-shaped orifices 2 inches maximum diameter and lined with sharp, white, tooth-like projections, probably mouths. All these tubes, cilia, and points of starfish head found folded tightly down. The tubes and points clinging to bulbous neck and torso.
And his report continued.
At bottom of torso, rough but dissimilarly functioning counterparts of head arrangements exist. A bulbous light gray pseudo-neck, without gill suggestions, holds greenish five-pointed starfish arrangement. Tough, muscular arms, 4 feet long and tapering from 7 inches diameter at base to about 2 5/10 at point. To each point is attached small end of a greenish, five-veined membranous triangle, 8 inches long and 6 wide at farther end. This is the paddle, fin, or pseudo-foot, which has made prints in rocks from 1,000 million to 50 or 60 million years old. From inner angles of starfish arrangement project 2-foot reddish tubes tapering from 3 inches diameter at base to 1 at tip. Orifices at tips. 4-foot arms with paddles undoubtedly used for locomotion of some sort, marine or otherwise. When moved, display suggestions of exaggerated muscularity. As found, all these projections tightly folded over pseudo-neck and end of torso, corresponding to projections at other end.
We were rapt with attention at what we were hearing.
Cannot yet assign positively to animal or vegetable kingdom, but odds now favor animal. Wing structure puzzles in view of probable marine habitat, but may have use in water navigation. Symmetry is curiously vegetable-like, suggesting vegetables' essential up-and-down structure rather than animals' fore-and-aft structure. Fabulously early date of evolution, preceding even simplest Archean protozoa hitherto known, baffles all conjecture as to origin. Complete specimens have such uncanny resemblance to certain creatures of primal myth that suggestion of ancient existence outside Antarctic becomes inevitable. Job now to get 14 huge specimens to camp without dogs, which bark furiously and can't be trusted. Must be the distinctive smell that's disturbing them. With 9 men, 3 left to guard the dogs, we ought to manage the 3 sledges fairly well, though wind is bad. I've got to dissect one of these things before we take any rest. I wish I had a real laboratory here.
The sensations of Parbody and myself at receipt of this report were almost beyond a description, nor were our companions much behind us in enthusiasm. Within an hour and a half, interest again rose. Lake, sending more messages, told of the completely successful transportation of the 14 great specimens to the camp. It had been a hard pull, for the things were surprisingly heavy, but 9 men had accomplished it very neatly. Now some of the party were hurriedly building a snow corral at a safe distance from the camp, to which the dogs could be brought for greater convenience in feeding. The specimens were laid out on the hard snow near the camp, save for one on which Lake was making crude attempts at dissection. Results, quickly reported over the wireless, were baffling and provocative indeed. Nothing like delicacy or accuracy was possible with instruments hardly able to cut the anomalous tissue. But the little that was achieved left us all awed and bewildered. Existing biology would have to be wholly revised, for this thing was no product of any cell growth science knows about. It had digestion and circulation, and eliminated waste matter through the reddish tubes of its starfish-shaped base. Cursorily, one would say that its respiration apparatus handled oxygen rather than carbon dioxide, and there were odd evidences of air storage chambers and methods of shifting respiration from the external orifice to at least two other fully developed breathing systems, gills and paws. Clearly, it was amphibian and probably adapted to long, airless hibernation periods as well. Vocal organs seemed present in connection with the main respiratory system, but they presented anomalies beyond immediate solution. Articulate speech, in the sense of syllable utterance, seemed barely conceivable, but musical, piping notes covering a wide range were highly probable. The muscular system was almost prematurely developed. The nervous system was so complex and highly developed as to leave Lake aghast. Though excessively primitive and archaic in some respects, the thing had a set of ganglial centers and connectives arguing the very extremes of specialized development. Its five-lobed brain was surprisingly advanced, and there were signs of a sensory equipment served in part through the wiry cilia of the head, involving factors alien to any other terrestrial organism. Probably, it had more than five senses, so that its habits could not be predicted from any existing analogy. It was partly vegetable, but had three-fourths of the essentials of animal structure. That it was marine in origin, its symmetrical contour and certain other attributes clearly indicated. Yet, one could not be exact as to the limits of its later adaptations. The wings, after all, held a persistent suggestion of the aerial. How it could have undergone its tremendously complex evolution on a newborn Earth in time to leave prints in Archean rocks was so far beyond conception as to make Lake whimsically recall the primal myths about great old ones who filtered down from the stars and concocted Earth life as a joke or mistake. It was after 4 a.m. when Lake at last prepared to sign off and advised us all to share the rest period his outfit would take. I gave Lake a warm word of congratulations, owning up that he was right about the Western trip, and we all agreed to get in touch by wireless at 10 in the morning. At that point, Lake would send a plane for the party at my base. Just before retiring, I dispatched a final message to the Arkham with instructions about toning down the day's news for the outside world, since the full details seemed radical enough to rouse a wave of incredulity until further substantiated. None of us, I imagine, slept very heavily or continuously that morning. Both the excitement of Lake's discovery and the mounting fury of the wind were against such a thing. So savage was the blast, even where we were, that we could not help wondering how much worse it was at Lake's camp, directly under the vast, unknown peaks that bred and delivered it. McTighe was awake at 10 o'clock and tried to get Lake on the wireless as agreed, but some electrical condition in the disturbed air to the westward seemed to prevent communication. We did, however, get the Arkham, and Douglas told me that he had likewise been vainly trying to reach Lake. He had not known about the wind, for very little was blowing at McMurdo Sound, despite its persistent rage where we were. Throughout the day, we all listened anxiously and tried to get Lake at intervals, but invariably without results. About noon, a positive frenzy of wind stampeded out of the west, causing us to fear for the safety of our camp. But it eventually died down with only a moderate relapse at 2 p.m. After 3 o'clock, it was very quiet, and we redoubled our efforts to get Lake. Reflecting that he had four planes, each provided with an excellent shortwave outfit, we could not imagine any ordinary accident capable of crippling all his wireless equipment at once. Nevertheless, the stony silence continued. And when we thought of the delirious force the wind must have had in his locality, we could not help making the more direful conjectures.